I'm going to talk to you. It's probably a little bit more practical talk, at least in optimization, than real algorithm development. Those days have kind of gone for me. I'm going to be talking about factor alignment problems in optimized portfolio construction. And just give you a little background. At Axioma, the big company is like about 12 years old, and we predominantly work in portfolio construction and risk management, and mostly for equity portfolios. So a lot of the discussions we've talked about with, you know, CDOs and other things with highly nonlinear payoffs is not something that we are looking at here. We're mainly focusing on equities. So this is just the management of stocks and traditional portfolio management. So we're going to, like many people, start by looking at a Markowitz type of model where we maximize some expected return. In the industry, expected returns are always given by alphas, and alpha, you know, clients talk about their alphas, that's their expected returns. So I may use the two interchangeably. this form of the problem is the most common used in industry. It's usually tried, the managers have a mandate, they try to manage to a specific risk level. Here I have a total risk constraint, but more in a long-only setting such as this, more commonly, it's actually active risks. You're trying to manage these holdings, but these holdings are actually what they call active holdings. So it's the difference between the portfolio weights and the benchmark weights. Otherwise, it's the same. So unlike others, I think, where we've started out, a lot of the talks so far have been, we started out talking about this model, talked about some of his issues, and then abandoned the model and talked about other ways to solve or handle these types of problems. In equity portfolio management, this is still predominantly, you know, by a huge margin, the way that portfolios are managed. And so what we're going to do is talk about one specific issue, a very important one that arises in the portfolio and in management of portfolios using this type of model. So let me, in order to, I guess, motivate this, we're going to start by looking at how this, you know, how is the covariance matrix and how are the expected returns constructed in practice. So we're talking generally about portfolios if they're U.S. assets, maybe a universe of 3,000 stocks or so. If we're talking about a global, then maybe they have a universe of 6,000 or even 10,000 stocks. So you can imagine no one estimates a Q just from a dense covariance matrix of historical data. In order to make it positive definite, you have to have at least as many periods as there are assets. So, you know, it's completely impractical. So the way that both the covariance matrix and the alpha are constructed is by looking at a factor model. So we model returns as just a linear, as an expression, this linear equation where X is a given set of factors. So every asset has an exposure to a factor. Factors, in this particular case, you know, we can think of them as being things that distinguish or drive returns. So it can be industries, it can be the size of an asset, liquidity, it's, you know, it's how value it is, how growth growthy it is, you know, what's its book to price, things like this. So these are the things that are typically used as factors in a model. To get expected returns, the way that typically, like, there's a lot of different ways, but this is probably the most common way, is to look at the exposures, look at the certain factors that have seem to have a risk premium, positive risk premium. So you're actually, there's a direction or a trend to the factor returns associated with that factor. Oh, by the way, I didn't explain this, but a regression is run in order to compute the factor return. So this is run each day or each week, each month, for a long period of time to get a series of factor returns. So this is solved with a regression, just to get a set of factor returns represented by F. The expected returns, again, is just exposure times the expectation of those factor returns. And typically you take a subset of it. They may not have an opinion on certain factors such as industries. they will then constrain their portfolios to be neutral on industries, but will want to take bets on certain things like momentum or value. The risk model, which is what we use to as Q, our covariance matrix, which is the variance of the returns, is equal to, is written like this. So basically, using this model, we write it as a factor exposure, we call it a factor matrix or a factor model like this, where X again is the given factor exposures. Omega is the covariance matrix of a set of factors, which is typically much less in size. So for example, our US model, we Axiom has a equity model. And for the US, we have 68, I believe, factors. So it's a dimension where you can actually estimate a covariance matrix reasonably well. You can hit 68 periods. We run daily regressions to get factor returns. So having, you know, 4 times that or even 4 years of data, however much we want, to estimate this omega is perfectly fine. Delta is assumed to be a diagonal matrix. So even though it's a dimension, the number of assets, it's assumed to be a diagonal matrix. So it's just of the residual. So for each asset, the residual returns, you just take the standard deviation of it, essentially, and that gives you the delta, or delta squared. So let me back up one thing. One thing to mention here again, when this is used in optimization, the expected returns are calculated like this, and the factor model is calculated like this, but the two typically come from very different places. The expected returns might come from a dedicated, what they call the alpha research group. And this might be a team who is dedicated, whose sole dedication is to have a set of factors and expressing views to come up with their expectations of returns. There could be another group that actually generates a factor risk model. Maybe they have their own proprietary model, or maybe they use a vendor's model, like Axiomas, for example. So these two set of factors, even though I've listed them the same here as being X in both cases, they're typically very different. So one of the things we're going to look at, you know, is say, are optimal NBO portfolios biased with respect to the certain risk model? You know, how does the risk model used in mean variance optimization affect the optimal portfolio? And one thing we're going to look at and stress is, why do estimates provided by the risk model that were used to construct the optimal portfolio, if you then measure risk according to the same risk model that you used in the optimization, almost guaranteed to underestimate risk, regardless of what risk model you use? Can an existing risk model be modified to be unbiased when used in optimization? So how can we modify the process a little bit? And more importantly, is mean variance efficiency, it's kind of compromised by this if it's not telling you the actual risk what it's supposed to. So can we modify the mean variance optimization in a way so that it can be made more efficient? So mean variance efficient being more efficient. So just to illustrate, we're going to look at the underestimation problem anyway. We're going to look at a long-only strategy. We're maximizing expected return, and all data that I'm going to use is actual client data. So there will be actual back tests using, it's not made up, I didn't make it up, I didn't estimate it. It was, you know, from some client. We're going to maximize expected return, a fully invested long-only portfolio. This problem had GICS industry constraints. GICS is an industry classification. It had active asset bounds and an active risk constraint of 2%, which means its tracking error relative to benchmark on an annualized basis could be more than 2%. The risk model used was Axioma's U.S. risk model. That's medium horizon U.S. Axioma fundamental model. A benchmark was Russell 1000 growth, and we rebalanced this portfolio on a monthly basis. And what we see, you can clearly see that what this is the frontier. This is the the risk and then the realized active risk. So you can see that for our predicted risk and realized risk. So you can clearly see that the blue line is above, which just means that for any given level, we underestimate a risk. So the risk target was 2% in this case, and we got 2.67%. Another way of looking at this that we'll look at sometimes is something called a bias statistic. This is something that's used in the industry to generally measure the bias in the risk. And for our purposes, just because in every example I'm going to show, the risk target was a constant value throughout, you can think of the bias statistic as just the ratio of the realized risk to the predicted risk. So you can see that the target then should be 1. If anything above 1 means you underestimated the risk. This dashed yellow line is a confidence interval on that risk estimate. So you can see that it's above even the 95% confidence interval. So there's clearly a bias in the risk estimate in this case. Using an alpha is constructed by a client and using a risk model built by Axioma. So in this case, what happens is, you know, the entire, you're shifting your point, I guess, on the efficient frontier. You wanted 2% risk, and you're at a point where there's 2.67%. And what clients typically do in this case, their way of correcting this problem, is they say, okay, well, I'll target 1.5, and then maybe I'll get 2. So they just play these games where if they want to, they'll bring it back down. They'll target 1.5 because they understand that there's this bias. They don't necessarily know what's causing it, but they just adjust the value so that they get their target and they stick within their mandates, which is very important for their investment mandate. But this is kind of a guessing game, and it's really just a symptomatic cure to the problem. And just to show you that this was just one example from one client. Here, there's 25 different back tests from 25 different clients. And, you know, we're fortunate enough that a lot of clients give us a lot of data. We can present things in a very generic way like this. But you can see that the bias is there in almost every single case. So in every single case, when you're using expected returns given by the client or the portfolio manager to maximize expected returns subject to their level of risk, it's always biased, and the shaded area gives the confidence interval around that, what it should be. So it should be, you know, always give them, say, 0.9 and 1.1 or so here, but clearly it's above in almost every single case. So there's clearly a risk underestimation bias in these optimized portfolios. You know, so how do we explain this phenomenon? We're going to go back and look at just the unconstrained mean variance optimization problem, where Q, again, given by the factor risk model that we described earlier. The alpha, we're going to decompose it into a part that is spanned. The alpha X part is the part that is spanned by the risk factors, and alpha orthogonal is the part that's orthogonal to the risk factors X. So you can think of this as that. This is the projection of alpha onto the null space of X, or alternatively, if you like to think about it, a regression, you can think about running regression where you're trying to explain your alpha by X, and this is the residuals of that regression. So what happens when this is used in mean variance optimization is the optimizer, because you really have factor risk, which was the X omega X transpose part, and you have the idiosyncratic or asset-specific risk, which was the delta, which remember we said was a diagonal. So the optimizer sees that there's no systematic risk at all in the orthogonal component of alpha. And so what happens is it's going to load up on that relative to it, because it thinks it says here, you got part of your alpha is not explained by the factors, and so it appears cheaper by the objective. So they have to pay the price in terms... It doesn't have to pay the price in terms of risk to get exposure to that component of alpha. And so it really overweights it. And there's some previous research that gives an expression for a very simple case. So if we look at a very, very, very simplified case, but I think it provides a lot of insight. So we'll look at a case where there's a single factor model. There's a single factor X. We assume that the specific risk is homoscedastic. That means every asset has the exact same specific risk. In that case, you can show that the holdings, or that's at least expected value of the holdings, is given by this expression here, where the sigma S is, again, is the specific risk of the specific variance of the assets, and sigma F is the volatility or variance of the single factor. Now, you can see that it's overweighted because the orthogonal component is overweighted because this expression here is obviously much less than 1, or less than 1. It could be much less than 1. And so it's going to really overweight the orthogonal component relative to the span component of your alpha. Now, clearly, you know, I say alpha orthogonal is overweighted. Now, what I think is important to mention here is how I go back to think about how the alphas are constructed. Portfolio managers, these alpha research teams, spend a lot of time trying to put together some kind of weighting of factors that they use. So let's suppose that a portfolio manager bets on value and momentum. And there's a lot of research to get, okay, this is my alpha factor, I mean, this is my value factor, this is my momentum factor, I'm going to weight this one by, you know, 10% and this one by 90% or something, whatever their weights are. But what he's doing that in isolation of the optimization. And so what happens when he gets here is that the risk is not really being accounted for correctly. So you're not getting the optimal risk-return trade-off that the mean variance optimization says you're supposed to get. And so what his all his research into trying to find these optimal weights is kind of thrown out the window. The optimization says, well, I'm not going to follow that because clearly there's part of it's a lot riskier than the other part. In multi-factor models, it's difficult to get such an expression that makes sense because of all the correlations. But we can show, and think of these lines, not as absolute values, but norms, that if you look at the orthogonal part of alpha relative to the orthogonal part of the optimal holdings, that this ratio is less, which basically means that the weighting or the portion that goes into the orthogonal part of holdings is much greater than was initially in the orthogonal part of the alpha. And that's, I guess, the best generalization of this that we can produce. But that's all for an unconstrained case. So now let's think about a constrained mean variance optimization and, you know, how can we get a similar measure there? So when we look at constrained mean variance optimization, we talk about, rather than talk about alpha, we're going to talk about implied alpha a lot. Implied alpha is just the alpha that you would have had to have used in a unconstrained mean variance optimization problem in order to get the exact same holdings that you would have got in this constrained case. So it's, you know, just straightforward from the KKT conditions, you can get what the alpha star is. One important result, I guess, that we're going to talk about, we're going to start mentioning this term AAF, or alpha alignment factor. This is something that we're going to introduce here to correct for this problem. And what we will, I'll mention here, but it'll kind of be motivated more throughout the talk, is this alpha alignment factor that we're going to discuss is the orthogonal component of the holdings, or a constant of it, a multiple of it anyway, and which is also equal to the orthogonal part of the optimal implied alpha. So these two things are the same, or at least multiples of each other. Now, to see just how bad it overweights in the in this typical setting where you're back to actual test, you know, from real actual portfolio managers, then what we're looking at here is the percent of the holdings that are spanned and are orthogonal to the risk factors. So the orange gives the portion of the risk, or sort of portion of the holdings that are orthogonal to the risk factors, and the blue part of the cyan part, the portion of the holdings that are spanned by the risk factors. Now, in trying to shorten the presentation a little bit, I realized that I accidentally deleted a slide. What I want to show was another chart just like this that showed the same thing for the alpha. But just in summary, it was much less, meaning that the portion that is spanned there is much less than it is in the holdings case. And in fact, for this particular risk model, it overloads it. The difference between the two is like a factor of 8, which means the portion of the risk factor, the holdings that is orthogonal to the risk factors, is about 8 times what the portion of the alpha that is orthogonal to the risk factors. So, and again, this happened because the optimization saw no risk in these factors. So is it true that the orthogonal component of the portfolio has no systematic risk? So one of the things we did was we said, okay, let's pretend that this orthogonal component of alpha is an actual risk factor. Let's go and let's treat it like we would any other factor when we're constructing our risk model. We put it in the risk model, or the returns model. We run the regressions on a daily basis, and we'll look at its statistics to see how it compares to the other risk factors. Here, we're looking at the root mean square of the t-statistics. And so the t-statistic, if it's about 2, means, and this is absolute value, then it means a statistically significant factor. You can see that in this, what we call unbiased setup, that means that was what the weights that were used in the regression. So it's that we use the same weights that we use when we construct our risk model. You can see that it's doesn't look too statistically significant. And, you know, it's below the median value of all the other factors. When we run the regressions, though, rather than doing a generic weights, if we use weights that are based on this actual portfolio, then we can say, well, while it may not have been that important for this particular portfolio, it explained a lot of the return. And then this is the same thing, we're just looking at it on a percentile basis. So how does it compare when ranking to others? So in the unbiased setup, this is the ranking where it compares to other factors. You can see it's at the low end in general. And when we have reduced portfolio weights, it's more at the mid-level. Another thing we look at is the statistical significance. So how many days was the factor statistically significant? Again, the median's around 20%. Some of these are by very thin factors. We use the complete GICS industry classification, which has 68 factors, which means our U.S. model is 78 factors. And some of them have like 3 assets, you know, in the U.S., in the Russell 3000 or something. So some of these are coming from that. And then finally, we look at the actual realized volatility of that factor. And you can see here that the volatility relative to other factors is actually pretty high, even in the unbiased setup. So now we've gone through and we've shown that there is certainly risk underestimation of optimized portfolios. The optimizer assumes that your orthogonal component has no systematic risk and overloads on it. And while the orthogonal part of the holdings is not an excellent, doesn't appear to be an excellent generic factor, I mean, it's not, if we knew what it was, it's not clear that we would add it to the risk model, but it does seem to be very useful for explaining the volatility of the optimal portfolio. You know, so what's the source of this risk, or where is it coming from? It can come from, you know, a variety of sources. Typically, the alpha factors, what the risk model may use one measure of risk, say book to price, where the alpha model may use a different model, a different version of our factor for value. It may use a bit to enterprise value. Constraints can also have an effect. Let's suppose you know, the limiting exposure to a certain custom factor like a liquidity factor. Then the liquidity factor can have statistical significance and thus also drive part of the difference, you know, causing the the portfolio not to be explained by the risk factors. And the same thing with technical factors. There can be different definitions of momentum that slightly differ, where it's really going to start overloading on not your factor, but the difference between your factor and the factor that was used in the risk model, which may not be what you wanted to bet on in the first place. So we've talked about this misalignment. You know, is it bad? When we work in theory, you know, some of the theory assumes that the orthogonal component of alpha is all noise. In this case, misalignment would certainly be, you know, bad, but that's not the case in general. In practice, the orthogonal component of alpha typically does have positive ICs, information coefficient. So you think of ICs, the correlation between realized returns and the expected returns. So it typically does have information in it. So misalignment could, you know, might be a good thing. Maybe we do want to load up on it. But we've already shown that it has systematic risk. And so I don't think you can say that it's neither good or bad. It just has to be managed just like every other trade-off in doing portfolio construction. So the way that we're going to try to tackle this and solve this problem is to look at an augmented risk model. We're going to assume that there's a true covariance matrix that's given by our initial one, plus we're going to add some initial factors, or additional factors. And we're going to assume that those additional factors are uncorrelated and orthogonal to the original set of factors. The idea is to construct the risk model, or we're actually going to, I mean, this is a more generic case, we're just going to actually simplify it to a subset of that and only look at adding one single factor. So we're just going to augment our original model, we call it QY, and just add one single factor, and make that factor orthogonal to the original factors. And we're going to assume that it's uncorrelated with the original factors as well. Okay. So now let's look and see what the effect of this is. So let's let H of Q be the optimal portfolio associated with the original covariance matrix, and H of QY be denote the optimal portfolio associated with the augmented. And then U of Q denotes the true utility. This means measuring the utility with the true covariance matrix, and U of QY, the true utility of HQY. So this is one thing that we can show is that based on certain assumptions that, well, as they describe, that are in papers I'll give references to later, though. But we can actually show that the utility goes up, and the amount by which it goes up is proportional to the square of the systematic risk in this additional factor relative to its total risk. So if you're missing something, if you're missing a factor, and there's actually systematic risk in that factor, then you can really push up the utility. What else can we say about this? So the optimal holdings can be given by this expression here, and the exposure to these factors is given by this expression. So based on this, we can see that, well, in order for this to really have any effect, what we need is that the augmented, you know, if this is a zero, then there's actually no effect. So what we want is to choose an augmenting factor Y that is correlated with the orthogonal component of alpha. So using an augmented risk model is really like tilting the portfolio in a direction that's away from Y, as you can see from this expression here. One other thing we say about this is that now, that was for a generic Y. Now let's assume that we let Y be the orthogonal component of alpha and just normalize, so that's norm of 1, then we can show that these modified holdings, the holdings after doing this, this is again the unconstrained case for now, is equal to the original holdings plus this adjustment here. Or, no, sorry, not the original holdings. It's equal to the, what would you get the optimal holdings just by using the span component plus this orthogonal component, this multiple of the orthogonal components of alpha. So by calibrating the single parameter nu that we introduced here, which was the variance of this additional factor, we can control, it gives us a method for how we can control the weight in the orthogonal components of alpha in the optimal portfolio. So returning, going back now to the more practical constraint case, what we really need to do is manage the exposure through the orthogonal component of implied alpha, not just alpha. But this is difficult because we would go back and think about, well, how was implied alpha calculated? Well, it was calculated based on the answer, having the answer to the optimization. So here I want to control exposure to something that I'm not going to know until after I've optimized. So we would need to reestimate the whole risk model with a new factor. We would need to, and then what you could do is then with that new factor re-optimize, get a new implied alpha, etc. This obviously would be a very monotonous process. We certainly wouldn't want to attempt to do that. It may not even converge. Alternatively, we can try to penalize the exposure to the orthogonal portion of implied alpha. But again, this would seem to have the same type of issue. You'd have to solve our balancing, get the optimal portfolio, determine the implied alpha, penalize the exposure to it, you know, modify your optimization problem, solve the rebalancing again, and cycle like this. Well, we found a solution to this, and it's actually kind of simple. And what's a little still short story is this. We've been doing this problem since 2005, probably, solving this problem that I'm about to describe. It's a robust problem. When we did it, we didn't have any idea about this alignment problem. But we knew about the risk underestimation, and yet we still kind of came up with this problem as a solution to the risk underestimation problem. It was only later, like probably 4 years later, 2 years ago, that we actually, I guess, did more research into this whole alignment thing and came up with the same solution. So that's kind of interesting. But this is a robust optimization problem, so I think it's still interesting to see it from that perspective. So the factor that we want to add can be solved by this problem. By looking at this problem, this is kind of the inner problem of the robust case. So given a portfolio W, what you want to do is find a factor that maximizes the variance of it, subject to the norm of that factor is 1, and it's orthogonal to all the other factors. When we do that, we're going to let this resulting matrix with the additional factor be Q prime. And then we're going to call the answer to that problem, the F that it got, to be the alpha alignment factor again. And we're now going to return to our original constrained mean variance problem. So we're maximizing expected returns, subject to a risk target. But now we're going to look at risk in this different way. Rather than looking at the original Q, we're going to look at Q prime, which was, again, Q prime was the solution to this. And I didn't work out, you know, too much the math, but you can show that the answer to this robust portfolio, the robust proportion, has a closed form solution, and that factor is actually is just this. It's the orthogonal component of the optimal portfolio again, or of W, because there W was fixed, and so that's the solution to it. Now, this optimization problem can then, because of that, the way that looks, this can be modified very simply to still be another quadratically constrained problem. It's just now it has this additional property. It's essentially like doing a rank one update, but the rank one update is done in a very specific way. It looks at makes sure that the holdings that you get, which is a variable there, you don't want to really penalizing the part that is orthogonal to the risk factors. So adding the alpha factor to the optimization problem is really like penalizing the exposure to the orthogonal implied alpha. And that's because, as I showed earlier, and I said I would show you again here, is that the alpha alignment factor that we just derived and shown here is actually the orthogonal part of implied alpha. And if you calculate it, actually that's just under one assumption that if you look at the, assume the specific risk is homoscedastic, then this is true. So I think that's a deep way of thinking about it, that you really are penalizing or limiting or managing your exposure to the orthogonal part of implied alpha. We still have to control this one parameter. So we've shown how to control risk by managing this one parameter. We still have to manage this one parameter mu, which is the volatility of the alpha alignment factor. I won't really go into too much about how we do that. We work with certain clients to do that, written papers on how to estimate this, but doesn't really add much to the talk. So if we go back and look at our original long-only strategy, we can now see that we added one line to it. So the yellow line was the unbiased risk prediction, the blue line is the base case, and now we have one additional line, the red line, and that's when running the optimization, but also using this alpha alignment factor. So we're using this modified risk model in the optimization problem. And here you can see that the risk is unbiased. It's like spot on in this particular case. So the risk target was 2, and the base case was 2.67. That means run without the alpha alignment factor. And then with it, the estimate was only 2.05, so certainly within any margin of error. If we look at it from the bias statistic, you can see that the bias statistic's close to 1, and certainly within the range of the confidence interval of the bias statistic. And what's interesting is that not only did we correct for the risk problem, so meaning that by using this alpha alignment factor, not only is now we're producing a portfolio that has the correct estimate of risk, but also we pushed the frontier up. So modifying the risk limit, originally just simply moved the position on the frontier, but using the alpha alignment factor actually pushed the entire thing up. So now there's two advantages to this. Not only do we push it up, but now we don't have to play this guessing game either. If we want to target 2, we put in 2% risk and we get 2. But this brings up, I think, an interesting point. So how can an approach designed to exclusively, remove bias in the risk prediction also improve the ex post performance? How can it push up return? So the application of risk models in this quantitative portfolio construction is not just about getting the forecast right. It's also doesn't just change the headline numbers. It actually has a material effect on the holdings itself. And so, again, if you go back to the alpha research and all this work that the alpha research team did on trying to get the right multiple of value to momentum, say, was thrown out. But they did a lot of careful research. There was the information in both. They wanted a certain weight. They wanted both of those to be represented in their portfolio. But if one of those factors was not represented in the risk model, they may have just been betting on one of those factors. So by doing this, they can then, it may push the portfolio such that it has the weights on the two portions of alpha that are equally represented in the optimal portfolio the way that the alpha research team had originally intended. And just to show that this was not necessarily a fluke, we look at the improvements in the IR over all those 25 back tests. So that, again, that was one case. If we look at this is the histogram of the percent improvement in IR. IR is the information ratio, which is the ratio of the annualized active risk divided by the average annual active return, active risk. So annualized active return divided by active risk. So in almost every case, there was 2 cases where it hurt performance, 3 where it didn't really do much, and in the other 20 cases, it helped. And if you done much in terms of back testing or any kind of financial optimization, I don't think there exists a method of any type that always wins. The markets are so, stochastic by nature that, whatever you do, even if it's a stupid idea, it's bound to win every now and then. One other thing I want to show is that, so this is, take a minute to explain, but this is the relationship between the bias statistic and the misunderestimation of volatility. So remember I said you had to estimate this one parameter, the volatility of this missing factor. So it's just one number that you have to put into the optimization to control this. For all these 25 back tests, we just used a single number. We didn't even tune it. So we used a single number. We used 30% as the volatility for this. So what we did after the fact, we optimized, we ran the back test with this. Now we have a time series of the actual alpha alignment factor. So we take the orthogonal part of the holdings, and we measure what was the realized volatility of it. The realized volatility of it was given by the purple. So you can see it by the purple line. So we assumed it was 30%. You know, here it was 20. Here it was about 35. Here it was over 40. Now, on the right scale, we're going to look at the bias statistic. So the bias statistic before using the alpha alignment factor was represented by the screen line. So you can see that, again, this is what we showed earlier, that it's always biased between 1.2 all the way up to 1.8 in one case. That was a very biased case. You underestimated by a factor of 2 almost. But what's interesting is the relationship between these two. Is that whenever we, this line here is the bias statistic after using the alpha alignment factor. Obviously, the 30% was chosen such that on average the bias was around 1. So it's unbiased on average. And if you look at any particular case, I mean, this is kind of a remarkable relationship, I think, between the bias statistic and the volatility of the alpha factor. So what this means is that it was really capturing this missing portion of risk. The only thing that was wrong is if we didn't estimate this one parameter correctly. So whenever we underestimated the volatility of that factor, that's when the bias statistic was low. Whenever we overestimated, the bias statistic was low. Whenever we underestimated the volatility of the alpha factor, the bias statistic was high. You can see that it's difficult talking about this bias statistic because if it's high, that means you're underestimating risk and vice versa. It's counterintuitive. So I think, again, that's just, I mean, to me, that's a kind of a remarkable that it came out to look that similar, which to me shows that it is capturing the missing, what's missing in the risk. It's just, you still have to get this one parameter close to right. I didn't think I was going to have time, but I also had one slide that showed the sensitivity of the optimization to this value. And for most of these problems, there's actually a very wide range of volatilities for this that you can put in. You know, I chose 30% here, but there's typically a very wide range that you can put in such that you get unbiased risk estimates. So it's not like you have to fine-tune this number to the third decimal place. Even getting within 5 or 10% is still extremely helpful in almost all cases. So the risk underestimation, just to start summarizing, risk underestimation of optimized portfolios was certainly present. The optimizer, this was because the optimizer was loading up on the orthogonal components of alpha. This orthogonal component of alpha or orthogonal component of optimal holding certainly had risk. So it was not just, it didn't just have specific risk like the risk model was suggesting. And that it does actually push up the efficient frontier in most cases. So sometimes people ask, do we really need the alpha alignment factor in this orthogonal part of the implied alpha or orthogonal part of holdings? Or could we just do something simple like penalize your orthogonal part of the alpha up front, modify your objective just with one additional term and use that? So we tried that, and the results are certainly not as good. Get represented the same histogram or the same back test. So this was run, and here we did actually try to tune the penalty that we would use on penalizing the exposure to the orthogonal part of just alpha, not implied alpha. So we did try to tune that, but still we found that it didn't have near the improvement. So it is important to also consider the effect of the constraints in whenever looking at this misalignment issue. To summarize, on Yurit Saxena, which some of you may know, he and I have been working on this together for a couple of years. We have several papers on it that are all available on our risk on our website. And one thing that we're looking at now is actually building custom risk models. So we developed some piece of software we call the risk model machine. So we stick in all of our risk models and all of the data necessary to build a risk model. And the user can modify the risk model. They can change the amount of data used, the half-lives used to calculate variances. They can take out some of our factors. They can put in some of their own factors. And we're finding this to be, you know, interesting as well, in that so what it's going to allow people to do is not necessarily have to guess you know, what a volatility of a factor is. If they have a certain alpha factor, you can just stick it in and it'll build a risk model then with that factor. We're finding that the alpha alignment factor still helps because of the consideration of constraints. What this is probably most beneficial for, and it'll be more topics for upcoming research, is in the explanation of returns. We didn't really talk about that, but not only is it important for portfolio managers to get good performance and manage the risk, but they also have to explain returns to whoever the investors are. You know, okay, you made 3% or you lost 4% or whatever it was. Why did you do that? What was it attributed to? It was attributed to, well, I bet on value did poorly. I bet on momentum. Momentum went great the past 10 years. And then last month, you know, I went down 5%. These are the types of things you have to explain. The alpha alignment factor, unfortunately, cannot obviously explain that because it's just a mathematical construct, which happens to work well, but it doesn't provide a lot of explanation. So that's why working on the custom risk models, where they can actually put in their own, the portfolio manager can actually put in a risk model, their own factors, helps with that piece. That's it.
Any questions, comments?